This is an ABC podcast.
Nisan Bolivinaka, Fagalovla Yatu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, welcome back to those who've probably enjoyed a very nice long Easter weekend. Hey, how many people are there in Papua New Guinea? Well, it looks like the country has launched its biggest population survey to find out. And the New York Times have called it potentially world-changing. Yes, shipping companies are stepping up to the plate to play their part in fighting climate change. And is China's influence in the Pacific bringing with it criminal activity? More on those stories shortly. Remember, wherever you are tuning in from, we appreciate it. Once our stories are up online, you can find them by typing into your search engine Pacific Beat and Radio Australia. We're across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. Really do love seeing the engagement there. But let's get on to the show. I'm Aggie Thupo and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. To Tonga, where King Thubol VI has held a critical meeting with his Privy Council in the northern island of Vava'u on Thursday. And that was to decide the fate of Prime Minister and Defence Minister Siausi Sovaleni and Foreign Affairs Minister Fikita Moiloa Utuika Manu. It is the culmination of a two-month process after the King withdrew his support for the two ministers via an extraordinary letter that led some to speculate that he'd lost faith in Tonga's government. The ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu, was in Vava'u for the meeting and she joins us now. With that, I say, Malo tau mai pongpongi ni toko.
Malo e pongpongi, tau mai pongpongi ni Aggie.
Thank you so much for joining us, Marion. Again, yes, you were there. And, you know, we talked about this last week as to the expectations of what could happen, but what did actually happen there in Vava'u?
So the meeting took place, obviously, and from then on, the meeting, the results of the meeting will have to be confirmed or distributed publicly by the Law Privy Seal. Having said that, the Law Privy Seal, William Malolo, will then advise the Prime Minister of the result of the meeting. The Prime Minister or the government will then advise the respected ministries of the finalizing of the meeting or the results of the meeting. From there is when we hear things, whether the government advises the public in the results of the meeting or not. But between the palace and the government, the Lord Privy Seal will have to advise the government with the result of that meeting.
Okay, Marion, so then are you saying that there is probably no indication if there has been a resolution to the standoff between the King and Prime Minister? I mean, have there been any resignations?
You know, there's no resignation confirmed officially yet. However, at the same time, Aggie, there is recommendation on the table and it has been confirmed. It hasn't been officiated yet, but it is confirmed that there is recommendation in this matter, whereas there is recommendation for the Crown Prince of Tonga, His Royal Highness Tupotoa, to be the Minister of Defence and Foreign Affairs, and for Fikita to be the Minister of MEDEC. So there is going to be a reshuffle. These are the recommendations. Mind you, Aggie, these are recommendations and it is yet to be officiated before it becomes, you know, the actual portfolio or, let's say, assigning them. But as of now, I have confirmation from a very, very reliable source that these are the recommendations put forward, but it is yet to be confirmed.
Marion, I know you just spoke there saying that Fikita could be, well, the recommendation is that she'll be the Minister of MEDEC. Well, can you just explain what MEDEC is for our listeners?
Okay, so MEDEC is it has a lot of department with it. So MEDEC is basically the Ministry of um, of meteorological energy, information, disaster management, environment, climate change, and communication. So all of this department or this branches are under one ministry, which is this, and it becomes the Ministry of MEDEC. If people, I think another way that I can explain this, this is where a lot of projects, overseas projects are being under, where there we have projects for climate change, we have projects for environment, we have projects for communication, which is where is our Tonga cable and our communication is basically under. This is a lot, this is not foreign affairs, but they deal mostly with foreign diplomacy when it becomes, when they work within this ministry, Aggie.
Thank you for clarifying that, Marion. I really appreciate it. If you're joining us this morning on Pacific Beat, we're speaking with our ABC reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupo, giving us really the latest updates on the outcome of the meeting that was held between the King, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Affairs Minister in Vava'u. Marion, is this then the last we'll probably hear of this matter?
Oh, no. I don't think so, Aggie. This is just going to be the beginning of this matter, given that then, you know, the King has obviously stated the revoke of his confidence. And I really do think this is not the last. There is the end of this government will be in the next year. So we will have the re-election of the new government for the end of next year towards 2025. So I don't think that this will be the end of it. Again, I also want to emphasize that revoking of portfolios is done only by the Prime Minister. Whatever the order reshuffle that's happening now, in this case, the Prime Minister did not recommend or revoke the appointment to these portfolios. And to answer your question, Aggie, it is not the end of it. We'll be looking forward to more in the future.
Okay. And then so what happens from now then?
So what happens now is it hasn't been officiated. So in the political system or how the government works in our constitution is the Prime Minister will give names. It's more like a recommendation to His Majesty. Okay, I want Aggie to be the Minister for MEDEC, whereas the King will sign, meaning that's his approval. Aggie, last year, two of the names of the members in Parliament, they are currently members of Parliament, two of them was recommended by the Prime Minister for two of the ministerial portfolio, which is the Ministry of Public Enterprise and the Minister of Tourism. Their names was recommended by the Prime Minister to His Majesty, and he did not sign, which means He didn't have to say it. He didn't have to write a letter. It just simply means that he did not want them to be minister. So, and those portfolios are still under the Prime Minister. Now, the recommendation by the Prime Minister now has been put forward, which is the Crown Prince to be the Minister of Defence and Foreign Affairs, and for Fekita to take up the ministerial portfolio of MEDEC. It has been put forward. It is for the King to sign. When he signs, that means he is approving of the recommendation by the Prime Minister. So that's how the system here in Tonga works.
Mm. Well, thank you, Marion, for even considering to recommend myself as a minister. but you're back in Nuku'alofa now. What's the feeling there, though, about this whole situation?
You know, everybody is so quiet because we, in practice, this is, you know, having Privy Council to meet with His Majesty, the results of each meeting is not publicized or acknowledged by to the public, there's a channel and there's a way, because the Privy Council meeting with His Majesty, they're basically just there to advise His Majesty. And it is up to the King if he wants to take on the advice of his advisors. The results of each meeting is not publicized, like I said. There's a channel of how the public knows. So normally the Lord Privy Seal would then gather all the results of the meeting, advise the respected government of the decision, if it concerns the government, of what the decision or the wishes of His Majesty. And that's how then it is up to us, the media, to hunt everyone to find the information from. This is not normal. That's why everybody was in shock when the Privy Council memorandum letter was leaked to the government. I mean, it was leaked to the public, because it's something very new. Any letter can be linked, but not leaking a letter from the Privy Council meeting. So as of now, it has to be approved by His Majesty before all this reshuffle of portfolios become in action. But as I mentioned, the recommendation had been put forward. It is up to the King to sign if he agrees to the recommendation that the government had put forward, or the Prime Minister.
Thank you for that, Marian Malo Apito. As you say, we know that this won't be the last that we hear of this matter, and so I know you'll be keeping us up to date. But appreciate your time this morning.
Malo Apito, Egi, and Ofato.
No worries. Marian, goine o ato fo ifasi. Pacific Beat. It's a few years late, but the government of Papua New Guinea has officially launched the country's biggest population survey. The last national census, conducted in 2011, is thought to be wildly inaccurate, undercounting the number of citizens by a massive 20%. Experts say the latest count needs to be properly funded to ensure accuracy and guide future government decision-making. Papua New Guinea reporter Belinda Cora has the story.
Papua New Guinea is by far the Pacific's largest country, with an estimated population of 11 million, but that is the problem. The country's last census failed to accurately calculate its population, and it's something the country wants to change.
You come in as businessman, businesswoman, or tourist, or work in the NGOs, or work in a public service, or in the private sector, or you're just passing through, you must be counted also. In this occasion, on the 16th of June this year, until 29th or 31st when it is completed, every human being in Papua New Guinea must be counted. Is that okay?
Launching the census last week, PNG Prime Minister James Marape spoke on why it is important and why it should also include non-citizens living in the country. And he has a strong message for all school leavers and university students.
They are savvy. They're engaged in Facebook right now. They're engaged in WhatsApp right now. They're in our society. And so through this occasion, I want to rally and mobilize all who have left grade 12, who have not found any place in our universities or colleges and in community. You come out right now, tomorrow starting, report to your district administrator or your provincial administrator. We want to know you. Get yourself counted.
The Prime Minister also has a message for all unemployed youths.
We will launch a program in Port Moresby City for all grade 12 graduates who are in city doing nothing. And this may also go out to all who have left colleges and universities who are unemployed as we speak. You come out. In this census, we want to know you first. You are an important contact point for us in society. You come out and you will partner the public servants in the count that we must do for yourself, your family, your people, and our country collectively.
Mahalopo Lavelle is a local economist who is now a FDC Pacific Fellow at the Lowy Institute in Australia.
The year 2000, and the 2011 census was faulty. So observers noted that, or at least estimated that, there was an undercount by about 20% of the population then in 2011. And so we really don't know. Very important demographic data, And this census will really fill that gap.
He says for this census, the most important factor is a commitment by government to ensuring sufficient funds to carry out the survey.
It's really a question of if the funds are adequate and if the funds can be accessed on time. And the opposition government has pointed out that there is there are lower funds that have been allocated and have been requested by the National Statistics Office, so that's a worry. But really, the census is it's very important. It needs to be done. The PNG government needs to work closely with its development partners, particularly with expertise in population counting. So, for example, the UNFPA, the Australian government, particularly the Australian Bureau of Statistics, academics as well.
Mr. Lavelle adds that the governance and planning of such important surveys must be taken into account, including assistance required from outside the country.
And it needs to conduct it in the time frame that it's already planned to set it out. And really, it can't afford to have this census fail, like the 2011 census fail. We've seen really large, major national exercises really leave a lot to be desired. So, for example, the 2022 elections was really regarded by most observers as an election that failed. The election before that in 2017 was regarded as an election that failed, right? And a lot of the problems involved in both those two elections plus the 2011 census have not really been addressed. So it's really addressing the capacity constraints within the National Statistics Office, really empowering the anti-corruption agencies and the departments, particularly the Department of National Planning that has oversight over the National Statistics Office.
And that's Lowy Institute economist Mahalopa Lavelle ending that report from Belinda Cora.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The New York Times have called it potentially world-changing. Well, what am I talking about? Well, last week, the members of the body that regulates the shipping industry, the International Maritime Organization, committed to creating the world's first global carbon price. Shipping companies that produced around 3% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions will now pay a fee for every ton of carbon they produce from burning fuel, all thanks to those Pacific nations who've played a prominent role in making it happen. The Marshall Islands and Solomon Islands have been amongst the loudest voices, calling for a levy, and they want to set it at $150 per ton. Dr. Peter Nuttall, the technical and scientific advisor to the Micronesian Centre for Sustainable Transport, says the IMO members now have to decide what form the levy will take, how will it be collected, and how the money is used.
Whether that's to be the proposal that the Pacific has advocated for, which would be a flat-based levy, or some sort of complicated trading mechanism is still yet to be decided. But the proposal put forward by the Pacific for a flatline levy is obviously great, gaining strength. We went into the debate with nine Pacific Island countries. We came out of the debate with all those Pacific Island countries joined by, I think, eight Caribbeans and at least a couple of Africans. And there's been a steady stream of phone calls from across the global south to our negotiating teams in the past week. So, yeah, the levy is definitely gaining traction at this stage.
And what do you and the other Pacific states who are backing it say is the benefit of this model, the flat levy, as opposed to the other two?
I mean, it's simply the most ambitious of the three measures and the strongest pricing signal. We've agreed at the IMO and in the revised strategy we all adopted last year that there were three basic jobs we had to do. We had to promote the energy transition of shipping, we had to incentivise the fleet, and we had to contribute to a just and equitable transition for all states. And it's that last one that's causing all the issues, because most of the other proposals recycle revenues from shipping companies that are highly compliant. They take penalties of companies that are underperforming and they give those penalties as a reward to overperforming ships. What none of those measures do is explain to us where does the revenue come to ensure that no state is left behind. And this is the critical point for the climate most vulnerable. Obviously, of course, we can't afford for there not to be a transition of shipping away from greenhouse gas, But at the same time, we can't afford for an inequitable system to arise where the poor and weaker states are left bearing most of the cost and burden with no incentive for them also to transition.
And a flat levy would do that, would collect all this money and then you'd work out some way to disperse it fairly and equitably.
Yeah, exactly. That's the current debate. And in our narrative, ours is the most simple process, the most transparent process, the most easy to understand process. It's all on the table. There'd be no exemptions. It would apply to all ships under all flags. Everybody would pay the same price on the bunker of greenhouse gas fuels. And of course, the more you save fuels, either by adopting wind hybrid propulsion to reduce your fuel bill or moving to new generation fuels or being more efficiently operated, then you're going to save money because you're obviously not going to be paying the levy. It's what we do with that levy that becomes critically important, how we use the revenues of that for those two primary objectives, incentivising the fleet, making sure that market leaders are incentivised to move forward with this transition, but also how do we resource that part of the world which obviously has not contributed to the climate change and simply doesn't have the economic resources on its own reconnaissance in order to bear this cost. So there has to be some mechanism by which revenues are dedicated to the purpose of elevating the position of the global south.
Is there a risk that the Pacific could lose out in terms of higher prices for the goods that are shipped to them, of which they are very dependent, as we know? Could that result in higher prices for stuff in the Pacific?
It will result in higher prices for stuff in the Pacific. That's inevitable. And the situation is, at the moment, that Pacific countries are already paying the highest price for goods anywhere in the world and will increasingly pay higher prices. That's inevitable, regardless of what the IMO does. The European Union has already introduced its own emissions trading scheme for international shipping that came into effect on the 1st of January this year, and all other countries in the world that now trade with Europe, including the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, everyone else, is now paying to the European Union for the price of emissions. So it's not a question of whether the price is going to go up. The price is definitely going to go up. It's how do we use the revenues from that levy to offset and compensate those countries that will be disproportionately negatively impacted.
And that's Dr. Peter Nuttall from the Micronesian Centre for Sustainable Transport, speaking to Liam Fox.
Hi, I'm Sayuli Salamasinovanraiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, welcome back. I'm your host, Agatha Ball here, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat. Well, plans are being drawn up to safeguard the identity of Vanuatu's unique variety of guava plants. It's called the Geographical Indication Bill and would authorise the use of special DNA marks on each guava variety so they can be identified after they've been shipped abroad. To learn more about this, we're joined by the man in charge of this project, newly appointed Director General of Vanuatu's Ministry of Agriculture, Livestock, Forestry, Fisheries and Biosecurity is Timothy Tumukon. With that, I say hello, bonjour, Mr. Tumukon. Welcome to the program.
Bonjour. How are you? Yeah, how's everybody?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Really, why is this initiative necessary?
Well, let's put it this way. Kava has been traded for some time, and we believe that it is timely we look at protecting our varieties. And the only best option we have at the moment is to ensure we have legal instruments to allow us to do that.
Mr. Tumukon, how much of Vanuatu's kava itself is actually already being wrongly marketed or maybe even pilfered by overseas traders?
I believe that's more than half what we are trading overseas currently is being wrongly labeled and wrongly traded. And that is why it's urgent that we have a look at securing our own product and their particular names and DNA marking.
Thank you for that. Now, I know that Vanuatu has at least 80 varieties of kava. Can you maybe take us through sort of the process of how you'll be able to really identify the DNA making of each plant?
Well, it's very simple. Nowadays, science has gone to the extent where you simply collect a particular variety, stick it under a machine that will do the analysis for you and then give you the DNA marking for that particular variety. We have done a lot of this DNA marking already of especially our popular varieties, the what we currently term the noble varieties and a few others. We have done those DNA markings already or DNA analysis. We have those available, but we need to do the others which are not so prominent that make up the 207 varieties that we have. And so then thereafter, we can then have a look at having this legislative framework to allow us to proceed with protecting them.
Mr. Tumukon, for those of us that may not understand the whole DNA marking, I mean, how will you go about marking the kava? Because I'm wondering, would you imprint them with a logo such as you might when branding cattle?
No, not really. It's basically having an analysis done in a laboratory, and then they come up with every particular varieties have their own code or DNA code, and using that, you can then differentiate one from another. Now, having said that, there's varieties and sub-varieties. It brings up particular issues with making sure that you are not differentiating or you're differentiating between a prominent variety and its sub-variety, meaning that you could have a twin in a family, but they are different. There's difference between them in terms of their fingerprints, their particular features, and this is what happens in science, especially to get differences between two identical individual physically. They can appear the same, but DNA or fingerprint-wise, they're different. And so this is the level we're going to with science. And using that, then we can try and having a legislation that allows us to be able to work through all these to make sure that we protect them.
Right, yes, that makes a whole lot more sense. Thank you for that. You're tuning into Pacific Beat. We're speaking to Director General of Vanuatu's Ministry of Agriculture, Livestock, Forestry, Fisheries and Biosecurity, Timothy Tumukon, on this geographical indication bill that hopes to safeguard the identity of Vanuatu's kava. Now, you just touched on it, the bill. I know that it's set to go before Parliament. Are you aware of when this will actually happen?
Currently with the political situation in Vanuatu, I'm not really sure when it's going to be tabled. But we are pushing very hard to ensure that the next sitting or the one thereafter, we should have this bill going forward. Now, having said that, I think Parliament is prepared to get this bill through. It's still also at the technical level. There are a few issues that we at the administrative level, we need to sort it out, have an agreement on, and answer the queries that are being raised by the drafters, our legal drafters, and then thereafter it should be ready to go into Parliament.
Nice. Well, Mr. Tumukon, what's the response been from the growers, though? They must be happy with these protections then.
Well, They are very happy. It's also something that it's beyond, you know, their head at the moment. We need to explain the issues to them and how our varieties have been taken advantage of overseas. And so we need to explain this very carefully to them. So their understanding is established. And then thereafter, they need also to give their agreement to us registering all these varieties. So that's it works in all sectors or segments of the stakeholders who are involved in the industry. The actual resource owners, which are the farmers, they need to have a good understanding of what we're doing, so that moving forward with it, everybody is well aware of what we are planning to do, and everybody is in agreement to it. So yes, farmers, the first discussions that we have had with them, they're very happy with what we're doing, but they just need to have a full understanding of the process and what it takes to get there.
Yeah, and I think of when, you know, when these protections are in place, the legal action that you may be able to take against those wrongfully claiming cover as their own, what would that look like?
Oh, that's another whole ball game that I'm sure will take a lot of your time to go through that. But we need to establish this first, and then there's processes, legal processes, both nationally and internationally, that you can go through to try and rectify some of these wrongdoings, so to speak, varieties that we have.
Absolutely. And, you know, it obviously seems very timely because we are seeing guava markets, you know, open in Indonesia, the likes of South America and even the USA. Does this pose a threat to Vanuatu's guava industry?
Yes and no. Again, I come back to protecting our guava. If we have our varieties protected, then we shouldn't be worrying too much. But right now, everything is open and open to others coming in and stealing our particular varieties and planting them. Having said that, you rightly mentioned South America and the Asian countries. Our climate are similar. So if they were to collect some of our planting materials, I'm pretty sure there would be a huge threat to our cover industry, not only in Vanuatu, but also in the cover-producing nations of the Pacific.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Tumukona. Obviously, congratulations on, you know, having to set this bill and get it through. We look forward to the protection of Vanuatu's cover there, but thank you again for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
No worries. That is Director General of Vanuatu's Ministry of Agriculture, Livestock, Forestry, Fisheries and Biosecurity, Timothy Tumukon, here on Pacific Beat. Up next, stay tuned, we've got your news wrap. Welcome back. Yes, it is that time where we head around the region. What is the latest headlines? And of course, our news wrap is brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith. Good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Let's get into it. Drought conditions are worsening in Micronesia. What's the latest update there?
Yeah, so much of Micronesia has been under severe drought conditions for the past few weeks, leaving thousands of people in need of food in the Federated States of Micronesia. Over the weekend, the US Drought Monitor upgraded the drought warning from severe to extreme for the island state of Yap, where alongside food shortages, the impacts there include taro patches drying up and coconuts drying out, as well as reports from residents of yellowing crops. The Guam National Weather Service says the current drought is likely to worsen over the next 1 to 3 weeks.
Awesome. Thank you for that, Mackenzie. Now we head to Bougainville. There's a major radio station that's been destroyed by a fire.
Yeah, the Post Courier reports that Bougainville's New Dawn FM station went up in flames last week in Bouin. It lost its transmitter, studio and properties which will cost an estimated 2 million kina in damage. A manager at the station Aloysius Laukai has written on Facebook over the weekend that he blames the damage on ongoing fighting between two conflicting tribes in Kano constituency. He says they haven't been able to visit the radio station premises in Buin yet, but they will have to start the operation from scratch. Dawn FM, though, remains on air in Buka and Arawa.
Goodness, unfortunate to hear that. Over the weekend, though, the Tokelauan community in New Zealand, they held a long-delayed Easter festival. What happened there?
Yeah, well, there have been many disruptions, including COVID. So the Tokelau Easter festival hasn't been held since 2017, but it was held over the weekend, and an estimated 3,000 Tokelauans attended in Lower Hutt. That's nearly twice the population that resides in Tokelau's atolls. Participants took part in dance, music and sporting events across the 4 days, and the festival was attended by the Ulu o Tokelau Alapati Tavite, who gave a speech alongside other community leaders there.
Beautiful. Always good to end off a feel-good story. Vinaka McKenzie, really appreciate your time this morning.
No worries.
That is producer Mackenzie Smith with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, the Pacific, it continues to find itself at the centre of a geopolitical battle for influence. And a recent 60 Minutes program claimed that a well-known Chinese businessman living in Fiji was a key operator for the Chinese Communist Party and a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate. But over the weekend, the Chinese embassy in Fiji put out a video refuting those claims. So more on this story. We are joined by senior fellow for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and visiting fellow for Canterbury University, Jose Sousa Santos. With that, I say bon dia, and thank you, Jose, for joining us this morning.
Bon dia, Aggie.
Yeah,
thank you very much. The pleasure's mine.
Thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. A lot happened, and I'm sure you probably saw that 60 Minutes video. But yeah, what were your thoughts about that from the Chinese embassy having to refute those claims made in that 60 Minutes Australian program?
The program itself was very interesting, and it was quite good to actually see that intelligence from Australia, the Australian government and its agencies was shared with the Fijian government, and left the Fijian government to then be able to follow its own procedures. But this is the one thing that we have to remember, is that this is the strongest piece of information that has been put out through this piece is what has been put out by the Australian government. A lot of what was put out as well tends to be contentious, and when we're talking about issues such as state condoned or facilitated operations, you need to ensure that you have the hard data to push it.
And I know there is a lot to unpack on the story itself, but let's get to the response from the China embassy. I mean, they say the 60 Minutes story was based on lies and speculation. What's your thought on that, though?
Well, I think that you would expect that from the Chinese government, and it's definitely not surprising that the Chinese embassy in Fiji denounced the claims. However, if I need to add that at a meeting of the Five Eyes Law Enforcement Group in 2022, Australian Federal Commissioner Rhys Kershaw stated the long shadow of organised crime is fueling state aggression and is fueling an increase in serious crimes. So there is a long-standing nexus between state actors and organised crime. So what was put out by the Fijian embassy isn't exactly true to what we've already seen. And what's been put out by regional law enforcement agencies.
What I thought was quite sort of unusual was, the step they took for the Chinese government to actually make a video. Usually they'd issue a bland statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Did you find that unusual or not?
I didn't. And it did seem to me that it was very much targeting a Pacific audience. And this shows just how much the CCP and its foreign affairs department understands the way that the Pacific works and the way the Pacific mind works and the culture, structured a message for the Pacific, not for other audiences. So if you're going to cause confusion, if you're going to create a message which is going to try to counter hard proof, you would counter with that type of response.
Yeah, once you sort of really looked into it, the 60 Minutes program didn't really have evidence of its claims against the Chinese businessman. I mean, do you think they were justified to at least to name him and raise those allegations against him?
Well, definitely. And I think one of the important things here is that the evidence put forward in the 60 Minutes show indicates that Zhao has been determined by the Australian law enforcement since at least 2021 to be a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate that has been active in the region for decades and likely has good access to corrupt officials, and that Zhao has been designated by the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, who added Zhao to its registry of Australian priority organisation targets in mid-2023, suggesting that Zhao is seen to be a significant threat to Australia. So, again, it's the information and the intelligence that's been made open by the Australian intelligence organisations, which normally would not be, which gives credence to these allegations.
Hmm. If you've just tuned in, speaking to Senior Fellow Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Jose Sousa Santos, about the 60 Minutes program claiming that a well-known Chinese businessman living in Fiji was a key operator for the Chinese Communist Party and a senior member of a transnational criminal syndicate. Jose, I want to get to this, and I'm sure you're aware of who the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime people are. They've launched this series of reports mapping regional trends in organized criminality. And they confirmed that China's increased presence brings with it criminal organisations. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
The dual nature of China's involvement in the Pacific is not new. And I can recall the discussions in Canberra in 2013 comparing how China utilised criminal actors and networks in other and other non-state actors in Southeast Asia, where I previously worked. And the likelihood it would mirror this behaviour tactics in the Pacific. Over the past decades, we've seen this manifest in the region in a number of ways. It is helpful to distinguish between state-condoned and state-sponsored or state-sanctioned transnational crime activities or operations. For example, state-sponsored or state-sanctioned activities are those that are carried out with active support of the foreign state. And that could be foreign some misinformation activities that could be hacking cyber crimes, and when you're talking about state condoned, and I think this is what we're looking at with Zhao, state condoned illicit activities is when for example transnational criminal syndicates which are not part of the state mechanism. But as long as their goals and targets coincide with the foreign states, or in this case China's goals and targets in that country, are given carte blanche and preferential treatment to be able to operate and in some ways to destabilize and to create pressure or even to narco corrupt elements within the traditional power structures and governments.
Okay, well, when I was watching the piece, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, he admitted that China could be involved in organised crime. So this leads me to my question: would have it been in his best interest to not have maybe gone ahead with this controversial policing agreement with China then?
It would be a big call, being that China is a big donor for Fiji, and then actually for most of Pacific Island countries. So I think this is something that that's been looked at very carefully by Sitiveni Rambuka and his government. And I do believe that, you know, one of the things that will come out of this, we've already seen that, you know, that the Fijian police force will not have a Chinese liaison within it. That's already been taken out of the agreement. But I do believe that we will see a redrafting of this agreement, which will be more to Fiji's control. And this is about national security as well, so that we don't see the same issues where, for example, China, working extrajudicially directly, government to government, and bringing in Chinese police onto Fijian sovereign soil and arresting Chinese citizens outside of the Chinese the Fijian judicial system.
All right, well, let's switch to the fact that, you know, Pacific seems like an easy target, you know, for the transshipment of drugs, again, vulnerable for meth, heroin and cocaine to come into the Pacific. I'm wondering, is there at least maybe a Pacific-led model to combat transnational crime?
Well, currently, the Pacific law enforcement architecture, where you have the Pacific Island Chiefs of Police, the Pacific Transnational Crime Network, the Pacific Transnational Coordination Center, and also as part of the security architecture, we have the Oceanic Customs Organization and others is tasked with addressing this threat, and it is at the moment adapting. It has been found lacking in some ways, but it is adapting quickly. It has realized that there is a threat which it wasn't aware of, and has developed and has become endemic to the region. Not just the trafficking of the drugs through the region, which has happened for decades, but we're now starting to see an overflow of these drugs to Pacific communities. We're now starting to see not just high level facilitators such as Zhao and other associates throughout the region, but also starting to see our own Pacific regional criminal syndicates now operating and facilitating the activities of these larger transnational criminal syndicates, be they Chinese, which of course are the ones which hold more political capital in the region. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the as the Pacific law enforcement architecture evolves, the very clear message is that it must be, for it to be effective in the region, it must be Pacific led and partner supported. And currently, the model is partner-led, Pacific-supported. And I think this is where there is a big chasm in what's being in the operations. What it leads to is the perception, also through the operations and the seizures, that the Pacific is being utilized as a buffer for both Australia and New Zealand to keep the drugs out of Australia and New Zealand. But not actually protecting the Pacific itself from these drugs and these syndicates.
Thank you for that. Jose, as we wrap up, we talk about Chinese aid, right? And I know that the Prime Minister stated he's got to make a bit of a delicate balance of anyone's influence in the Pacific. But when you think about in terms of aftermath of natural disasters, yes, outside aid would be helpful, right? But what else can be done in terms of international influence?
The Pacific sees China as a development partner outside of the security sphere. One of the biggest issues here is where China can become a disruptive, is seen as being involved in disruptive engagement in the Pacific. Is that it does not engage in the region, be it in regards to aid or security through the regional architecture. It attempts to do it bilaterally, and for example, in March 2022, just as the border started to open post COVID, and Pacific Island countries their economies were under duress, China very quickly came in and offered a multilateral agreement to the Pacific for security and for economic support. Mm. Now, of course, this was rebuffed because this would be basically creating a competing architecture to what's already in place. But then what we saw is China doubled down very quickly. It adapted to what had happened and doubled down on its bilateral engagement, Pacific region, Pacific countries. So you do have a country which can behave in a disruptive manner in the region, and that of course means that it needs to be brought into account for that that it's not just a positive force in the Pacific.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we just want to say obrigado, Jose, for joining us this morning, giving us a little bit of insight into this topic.
Obrigado, Baraka, Aggie.
No worries. That, of course, is Senior Fellow, Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and Visiting Fellow at Canterbury University, Jose Sousa Santos. That really does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat. In Tonga, the Prime Minister, Siausi Sovaleni, has made a critical recommendation to the King that may concede his defence portfolio and that of his Foreign Affairs Minister, Fekita Moiloa Otuika Manu. You can find our stories at Pacific Beat Radio Australia. Up next, you've got your news, and then up after that, it is Nisha Daily. We are Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.